welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. The first update I have is the LQ status report. Kind of in commemoration of this recent 6th year anniversary that we celebrated, I posted what I'm calling the LQ status report in the suggestions forum at LinuxQuestions.org. Basically, what I'm looking for here is an assessment of what we're doing well, where we can improve, what sites maybe we should focus on, pretty much any feedback you have on any aspect of the site, we'd like to know about it. A quick update. Last podcast, I had mentioned that Firefox 1.5 had been a little bit unstable for me. I was fairly surprised at the feedback I got. Quite a few people contacted me and said that they were having similar problems with stability. I'm happy to report that someone from Firefox actually was listening and had contacted me today saying that they did just do a release today that focuses quite a bit on stability. I haven't had a chance to try it out yet. It just came out just a couple hours ago, but I will be trying that. I encourage you to try the new version, and I will be updating you on the status of that hopefully next week. The last LQ update I have is that the LQ bookmarks site is moving. A little over a year ago, we released bookmarks.linuxquestions.org, which is a site for social bookmarking, tagging, and annotating pretty much all things Linux and open source related. Now, the site has had decent adoption, but not to the level really that I would have liked. I think one thing holding the site back was a lack of an integrated login with the main site. And what I mean by that is, even if you had a linuxquestions.org username and password, when you went to bookmarks.linuxquestions.org, you had to create a whole new username and password. Realistically, we're closing in on 300,000 registered LQ members, and we just were not taking advantage of that with the bookmark site. Also, the site was very functional, but a bit plain even by LQ standards, and if you've been an LQ member for any of the past 6 years, you know that functionality trumps design pretty much every time in LQ. We're not real flashy, we're not real glitzy, we don't do a lot of things design-wise. You know, we're mostly about the content, but the bookmark site was extremely bare. So I'm happy to announce that we just relaunched the site, and we're going to move it from bookmarks.linuxquestions.org to www.linuxquestions.org/bookmarks. So the new site has an updated look and feel, and it's in line with the rest of the site, actually. It uses the standard headers and nav and all that. It does now have a unified LQ login, which I think is going to help this a ton. And we also have some advanced things that supports almost the full Delicious API. It has a nice tag cloud and uses Ajax and all those kinds of Web 2.0 goodness, and quite a bit more. Now, if you use the old site, all is not lost. You can actually import your bookmarks to the new site with just a single click. It'll import everything, the tagging, everything will come right over. All you need to do is say, here's my bookmarks.linuxquestions.org username and password, and it will suck it right down into your account. Now, the site should be considered beta for now, but things seem fairly stable at the moment. As always, your feedback is welcome. As for the old bookmarks.linuxquestions.org site, we're going to leave that up for a little while, mostly so you can get your old bookmarks out, but also just to allow for some transition in general. Now, once we turn the old site off, we will be redirecting all the old tags from the old site to the new site, the user pages from the old site to the new site, so any bookmarks you have to the bookmark site, it's a little bit of a mouthful, should actually continue to work even after we change. Now, onto the news. The first story I have is the story I promised during last week's podcast, and that's Google announces hosting for open source projects. And like I said, I'd mentioned this service that was announced at OSCON last week, and it has been officially announced now. They're calling the project Google Code Project Hosting, which is kind of a plain name. And it's a place for open source projects that fall under an approved license to host their code at Google. Now, while this shares some features with SourceForge, it's definitely a much more minimalistic approach. Although it should be added, they do claim that it's not feature complete yet. They just wanted to get what they have out there. So I don't know what else they will be adding, but it, at this point, it is very, very minimal. One thing that I thought was interesting is that they specifically stated that they do not intend to compete directly with SourceForge. And the person that made the announcement is Stein, an employee at Google, and this is a quote, "We really like SourceForge, and we don't want to hurt SourceForge or take away projects. Instead, Stein says that the goal is to see what Google can do with the Google infrastructure to provide an alternative for open source projects. And that's end quote. And then Chris DeBona added that, quote, "This is a direct result of Greg concentrating on what open source projects need. Most bug trackers are informed by what corporations and large projects need, whereas Google's offering is just about what open source developers need," end quote. Now, while Google does not offer project website hosting as part of this, and that's a big part of what SourceForge offers, you could actually use Google Pages. It's not integrated, but of course you could use it and then point to it. Also doesn't have forum and many of the other things SourceForge has, as I said. One thing that I noticed is that many SourceForge projects don't really seem to use a lot of this functionality anyways. Of course, a lot of them do use the website hosting, but a lot of the other things you'll notice, you can go to a whole section and it's completely blank for a large portion of SourceForge projects. So what Google is offering seems to directly target the places where you hear the most complaints about SourceForge, and that's reliability, search, and version control. So you have to assume it will be reliable. It's Google, and almost everything they do, I think maybe aside from Orkut, which I believe was their only Windows project, and that was either slow or down quite a bit, but unless they're ramping up something new that gets mass adoption, Google tends to be extremely reliable and performant. And the same obviously goes for the quality of the search. Now, to be fair, the SourceForge search has been improving somewhat recently. It used to be terrible, and it is improving, but it's nowhere near, obviously, as good as Google technology in that regard. The CVS support at SourceForge was just horrific. You'll see nothing but complaints, and even when we tried to use it for one LQ project, it was either down or behind or quite a bit of problems. And they still seem to be having a little bit of problems with the new subversion support. They're just kind of ironing out some of the kinks, I think, but it does seem to be better. Google, however, is offering a subversion with their custom Bigtable backend, so it should be just extremely scalable, and I do not envision them having any problems with it, which a lot of open source projects here are going to really appreciate. The issue tracker the site uses is one developed by Google, and as Chris kind of alluded to, it's not kind of your standard issue tracker. It is something that was built with open source in mind. I'm going to guess that the long-term impact of this project hosting on SourceForge won't really be clear until we see what the Google offering looks like when it's, you know, feature complete. For now, both sides seem to be looking forward to a peaceful and almost really symbiotic coexistence, and I think that shows and underscores the maturity and really solidarity of the open source community. The next story I have is Elson Talks Up Red Hat Linux. I covered this briefly in a previous podcast, and it seems like the rumors that Oracle may offer Red Hat support are intensifying here. One thing that seems to be slightly misunderstood, especially by some of the mainstream media articles that I've been seeing, is that Oracle can't simply just redistribute RHEL, which is Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and then offer support for it. What they could do is offer a RHEL-compatible version of Linux, kind of like CentOS does, that is completely devoid of the Red Hat name, any associated logos, basically anything that's trademarked has to be ripped out, and then they can offer that, but it wouldn't be RHEL, it would be RHEL compatible. When I covered this previously, this would be a fairly inexpensive thing to do for Oracle, especially considering the kind of money Oracle has, and to be honest, I don't think there's a lot of downside to doing this. Now, Elson would get his entire stack, which is something he's talked about for quite a long time now. He just seems to desperately want to have control over the entire stack. And customers, and enterprise customers especially, would get a single neck to choke, which they absolutely love. Even though, you know, it's funny, many enterprises, they don't ever actually choke the neck. And even if they could choke it, really nothing would come out of it. They wouldn't get anything back. It's just something that especially C-level executives just seem to love it, regardless of what it actually gains them. It's more of a perception thing, and that perception is important. As I also mentioned when I previously covered this topic, I don't necessarily think this would be a bad thing for Red Hat. It would serve to further solidify Linux as a platform of choice for Oracle, and really it would serve to further validate Linux as a server in general. Realistically, I don't think it needs any more validation on the server side at this point, but it doesn't hurt when a company like Oracle says that their main product is best run on Linux. So while Red Hat may lose some support contracts to Oracle in the short term and maybe even the midterm, the mindshare that Linux would gain almost certainly would benefit Red Hat in that medium to long term. So it could be a short-term loss, and I wouldn't doubt that their stock would take a short-term hit. But as far as long-term viability goes, I think it would actually help. Now, contrary to that, if I were Microsoft, or especially Sun, where Solaris is huge historically with Oracle, this would definitely worry me much more, because they just have so much more to lose than Red Hat does. The next story I have is Ballmer analyzes Microsoft's one big Vista mistake. This story covered a recent meeting that Steve Ballmer had with industry financial analysts. And from the article, we get such Ballmer quotes as, quote, "We made an upfront decision that was, I'll say, incredibly strategic and brilliant and wise and was not implementable," end quote. And the next quote is, quote, "We've been fortunate. There is nothing that we have undertaken, with a couple of exceptions like Microsoft Bob that I'll cop to in advance, where we have decided that we have not succeeded and let's stop. We've either succeeded or we're still telling you we're going to succeed," end quote. Now, if you listen to those two quotes and don't understand them, don't worry. I don't understand them either. I'd not call any decision that is not implementable by admission of the company CEO as strategic, brilliant, or wise by any stretch of the imagination. If I were a Microsoft employee, that comment would make me a little bit worried. In the end, it seems they may have finally learned a lesson that Joel posted about way back in 2000. And by Joel here, I'm talking about Joel on Software, which is a very good blog. If you don't read it, I highly recommend it. It's easy to say hindsight is 2020, but I guess that foresight can be also in this case. And I linked to this post on my blog recently. It's a post about trying to rewrite things from scratch and the uphill battle and failures that it will almost certainly lead to. And in his post, he pointed out Netscape as a good example when they rewrote things from 4 and then ended up with 6 years later at a failure. What Microsoft did with Vista kind of underscores that same theme. So moving on to Ballmer's second quote, it's just equally as odd. "Multiple things, obviously, that Microsoft has tried have just failed miserably. And in fact, he points out one of the most egregious examples himself in Microsoft Bob in the middle of saying that nothing hasn't succeeded." So the mind reels. I guess one shouldn't be surprised that Microsoft stock has stagnated during pretty much all of Ballmer's tenure. Still no news on whether he'll follow Bill and step down, which is obviously a topic I've covered quite a bit on the podcast. The last story I have is second discussion draft of the GPL version 3 has been released. So the second draft has been released of the General Public License version 3, and it came along with the first discussion draft of the GNU Lesser GPL, or LGPL. While the DRM clause has been updated and clarified, and I covered the original DRM clause quite a while back in the podcast, and it was definitely a topic that got quite a bit of scrutiny, Linus still doesn't like it. And this is a quote from Linus from a CNET article. Quote, "Say I'm a hardware manufacturer. I decide I love some particular piece of open source software, but when I sell my hardware, I want to make sure it runs only one particular version of that software because that's what I validated. So I make my hardware check the cryptographic signature of the binary before I run it. The GPL V3 doesn't seem to allow that, and in fact, most of the GPL V3 changes seem to explicitly be designed exactly to not allow the above kind of use, which I don't think it has any business doing," end quote. If you're following this one, you know that the DRM debate here is getting really, really heated. Out of my disdain for DRM, I initially disagreed with Linus. But as I think about it more, I'm starting to agree with him, and let me explain why, because I know most people think DRM is just insidious, so they tend to be anti-DRM at any cost. So his contention, or I guess I should clarify, my interpretation of his contention is not that DRM is good, it's that it's not within the rights of a software license to put restrictions on a hardware device. I think that's true, and the clause is also, I think, a statement that markets don't work. If some hardware vendors out there want to make a device that only runs software version X, I can't see a problem with that, as long as the hardware manufacturer is explicit in that requirement. So if he claims that it just runs you know, let's use Firefox as an example, and then it only runs a certain version, I'm not okay with that. If it actually says, hey, this only runs Firefox 1.5 point whatever, that's a statement that's true, and that you're buying that device with that statement being on the box. I do not have a problem with that. You know full well what the restrictions are, and you're free not to purchase such a device based on that information, and if a significant number of people do not, the company will go out of business, and the market will have made the decision. Now, let me go from a hypothetical to a situation where I think this would actually be useful. Firefox, admittedly, was not a great example. I'd like to see all voting software open sourced. The nature of voting in a democratic country like the United States is such that we should have full access to the code that decides our leaders, in my opinion. A single bug could be absolutely detrimental and have astounding implications. We might end up getting Bush for a third term or something. So the more eyes on the code, the better. But the voting machines themselves should certainly only run the exact version of the code that has been certified by the hardware manufacturer for what I hope are obvious reasons. The GPL version 3 seems to preclude that possibility. DRM aside and on a different topic, it seems like many other large companies, such as HP, have problems with other clauses. All in all, it seems like version 3 of the GPL really is going to have a very, very rough time gaining adoption, and it may actually serve to further polarize the open source licensing landscape where concerns over proliferation already just abound. So hopefully further drafts, let's say maybe a third draft of GPL v3, will change some of this and get more people on board with this. Because if the Linux kernel and HP, and I haven't heard IBM yet, but if all these companies stick with version 2, we're going to have a lot of unnecessary incompatibilities here, which is something we want to avoid pretty much at all costs. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.